wage slaves? Answer me that.
No.
No, of course not. Well, what makes wage slaves? Wages. I want you to be free. Remember, there's nothing like liberty, except Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. Be free, my friends, one for all and all for me, and me for you, and three for five, and six for a quarter.
Good morning. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. And today, hopefully you heard that little YouTube bit, we're going to talk about work. Some of you may be at work right now. Some of you may be driving to work. Some of you may not be. But it's something I obviously think about a lot. And lately I've been I didn't have a guest last week and talked about something I'd just been, you know, musing about. And it was about evil in general. And that was kind of sparked by having seen a film that just came out, Hannah Arendt. And then this week I hadn't come up with a plan yet for a show. I was unfortunately procrastinating, but also working, having to make money. It's, you know, the end of the month, got to pay rent, got to pay the bills, all of that. And this is not my paid job. So it sometimes gets pushed to the back burner, which is frustrating, you know, because it's what I enjoy doing. I'd like to spend more time doing it. And I thought, what better topic than work and wages and all of that great stuff to talk about. And I happened to be watching a friend's house who has cable. I don't, and haven't had a TV or cable for a long time. So it's like this weird exotic thing for me to be able to, you know, flip through this vast offering of stuff. And I happened to see that there was a documentary on that I hadn't watched because I felt like, you know, I already know I don't really need to watch it. But it was Walmart, High Cost of Low Prices. And this was made, I think it was quite some time ago, but it's also safe to say that Walmart hasn't really changed their business practices much since this movie's come out. I'm just looking up when it came out right now so that I know for sure. 2005, yeah. So it's a pretty interesting documentary, though. I ended up watching quite a bit of it. And Walmart is obviously the foremost example of corporate behavior in the U.S., which controls a lot globally. And more Walmart is present globally, and they're exporting their community dynamics, I guess we'll say, to other places. And I don't think it's very effective to just rail on Walmart and say, oh, don't go to Walmart. That's the most evil place in the world. It's worse than anything else. It's slightly worse than everything else, big corporation-wise. But the distinction between it and others is fairly negligible. And I think, you know, we should come from more of a macro level and get rid of all of that type of stuff. So that's something we'll talk about. But so watching that documentary, there's a lot of interviews with employees and small business owners who are put out of business by Walmart arriving and things like that. And it really just brings to light a lot of these issues, talking about work, talking about especially, you know, what we'll call in this show wage slavery, you know, the trap of working for minimum or low wages, having bills, not having a lot of ownership or self-determination in your life, and also not really having a path out of that. So the film, the documentary is pretty good. There's a lot of interviews with workers who, you know, they were excited a lot. I was surprised at how many were, you know, they're really excited to be going and getting a job at this big company because they make a lot of great promises to their employees that, you know, you'll be treated really well. There's a lot of room for, you know, we do 4% raises every year. You'll be getting raises. You'll be getting promotions. There's always room in management. It's very mobile. And the interviews they focused on were with folks who that had not happened for. And I think a lot of large companies have the ability to do that because they can sell you the grand vision and talk about how successful the company is, how they're making millions in profits, and you're going to be part of that. But it was also powerful in this film to see how being in that kind of environment caused so many of these workers to to come to a realization about capitalism. A lot of them didn't name it that, but finding that those millions weren't meant for them. You know, they were meant to continue to make $6, $7, $8 an hour, depending on what state they're in. And if they were promoted, they were generally white males who were promoted, and that's systemic throughout the Walmart system. Throughout different stores around the nation, there's been lots of studies about it. Women in leadership roles are rare, and there are a few interviews with women who are just treated horribly there. Not the focus I'm going to completely fixate on, but so that documentary was quite good. I recommend it to folks who want to see it, and I think it's on Netflix. I think it's probably completely free on YouTube somewhere also. You could buy it and support the producers of it, I guess, is the option I should extend first. There's all kinds of ways to do it. So talking about work is very vague. The actual definition, dictionary definition of work, activity involving mental or physical effort to produce a result. So, duh, yes, but the part that I think is interesting is produce a result. So what's the result that you're producing? And for most people, their job, I consider a job is like the special kind of work that you do where the result you're producing is money. You're producing another result. But generally, I think we can generalize that a job is where you go to produce whatever result it is. And maybe it's something you love. Maybe it's something you just have to do. Maybe it's flipping burgers, whatever. But the result you're producing is money so that you can secure everything else that you need for your life. And I don't know if there's really a word for the other kind of work, you know, that we just do because we want to. It's still work, but I feel like in the U.S., there's kind of a connotation around the word work that it's something, that it's drudgery, you know, that it's like, oh, we're gonna have to work, it's gonna be, but there's also this real worship of the idea and the whole Protestant work ethic and hard work and sweat and toil and all of that. And somewhere in between, I think, is where we can focus. So, I mean, everyone I know, everyone I know, safe to say, does work that they're not paid for, whether because they have to, such as, you know, parenting, cooking, taking care of themselves. That's work. You know, it takes work to do all those things. But aside from that, so many people I know work either in a volunteer capacity for an organization they care about. They do something like, I mean, I do this show because I really enjoy doing it. Artists, a lot of artists I know, you know, they want to be their job. They want someone to pay them to do art, but they don't, that doesn't always work because, the way that art has been commodified doesn't work for all types of artists, but there's people who still do it. You know, they wait tables to make some money and pay rent, and they put the rest of their time into making art. Gardening is a good example. No one's really, most gardeners I know aren't going and selling their produce. They're often giving it away, you know, the surplus that they're not eating. And, but they do it. It's hard work. It's, you know, it messes up your hands. I know people who have arthritis from gardening and they still do it because they love to do it. I mean, any sports that people do, any crafts people do, research, reading, building stuff. I know a lot of like hobby carpenters and people with shops and such, and it's not their work, but it's, you know, it's important. It's stuff that actually needs to be done infrastructure wise in the US. None of it's being paid. It's all just done out of the pleasure of working. It's, you know, it's not really fun, at least for me, to just sit around for too long. You know, sometimes it's nice to kick back and do absolutely nothing, but I think our bodies need to be doing stuff. They need to be moving, and that's either going to be purely recreational or it's going to be work. And I think our minds kind of in the same way need to be doing something. So what's wrong with jobs? Nothing necessarily, but I just think it's interesting because it's such a focus of the political conversation, these days. You know, every politician, everyone running for office, as we're seeing right now, because it's that time again, on the local level, we'll talk about jobs and talk about how it's so important that we get people back to work and jobs this and jobs that. And what we don't hear as much is an analysis of, you know, what kind of jobs, what work needs to be done. How are we going to put people to work? What does, you know, what is the role of politicians and the government in doing that? We did have some of that conversation, I think, on a national level when, because Obama was talking a lot at the beginning in the early days when he was talking about this idea of green jobs. You know, that was elevated to a national level of dialogue for a little while. I didn't see much success coming from the federal government subsidizing projects that did that. And if they did, it was the kind of funding that injects into projects for a year or so. And since they were completely reliant on a grant of funding, they dissolved once again afterwards. So it doesn't make a great case for that specific structure of supporting certain types of jobs. Can something like that work? Possibly, but I don't really want to go all the way into that. But why are jobs so important? You know, we obviously want people to be able to support themselves. We want people to not be in poverty. We want people to not be hungry. By we, I mean, you know, you and I, nice people. There's no advantage, if you're going to think logically about the situation, there's no advantage to having hungry people as far as macro level, like the whole society. There's no advantage to that. So unemployment is kind of a tricky thing to track down. But right now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has like an 8% unemployment rate across the whole country. And Spokane specifically, have some info on just Spokane. It's 17.9% unemployed in the county. So that's pretty close to one in five people. And that's crazy, right? That's a lot of unemployed people. And at the same time, there's a lot of work to be done. So that's the main thing I kind of want to focus on. I'm totally open to take calls today if folks are interested in chiming in on this idea of working jobs. What kind of jobs do we need? How do we get them? Why should we have them? What's, you know, what's the point in working for money, etc.? Whatever question you want to address, the studio line 747-3807. So give me a call if you're interested. I also, I mean, for me as a younger person in the U.S., that's where I tend to focus. And I know that the unemployment rate for people under 30, I think they measure 18 to 25 as a unit. And then there's other data that goes a little bit higher. It's much, much higher than that of the whole population. And a lot of the jobs that are open to us as young people are service industry. And sorry, I'm trying to open the table right now and think at the same time. Nursing. I know a lot of people going to nursing school right now. That's school. You know, that's debt that they're going to accumulate. But hopefully, you know, they hope be able to pay it off. But these are the industries with the greatest job growth right now. I think I've shared this data on the show before. But retail salespersons is the second largest, fastest growing projected through 2020. So you can do retail sales. Home health aides and personal care aides are also on the rise. We have an aging population to take care of. Those jobs, the medium annual wage for both of those two, home health, personal care, and retail, they're all about $20,000 a year, which is less than the median in Spokane County, which is about $30,000 a year, and puts you not far within striking range of the federal poverty guideline. You'll qualify for food stamps on any of those three fastest growing jobs. General office clerks make a little bit more, but not much, about $5,000 more a year. Combined food preparation and service workers, including fast food, one of the top 10 fastest growing jobs, making $17,000 a year. Customer service representatives, including telemarketing, etc. And that bundles in a lot of different fields together. That's still underneath the $30,000 mark. Laborers and freight, stock, material movers, heavy truck and tractor trailer, heavy tractor trailer truck drivers. Wow, that's a tongue twister for me in the morning. Those are making more. That takes some training. And then child care workers, $19,000 a year. Cashiers, $18,000 a year. So most of these jobs that actually have growth in, you know, in their fields are not super, they're not very high paying, and they don't require a college degree. So there's so many people now, young people who have come out of college, have their degree, and the only, in a lot of cases, the jobs that are open to them are jobs like these, which they have huge competition from, you know, from people who have not gone to college. And then also from older people who have been laid off and have more job experience. That's a huge category of competition for them. So basically, a ton of different people are competing for these jobs, which, you know, as far as personal satisfaction, there is a lot of satisfaction, I guess, that comes from, you know, being useful, helping people. And that's something that's missing from a lot of people's lives right now. I think it's safe to say. Just the idea that you're helping someone, even if that's, you know, you're helping them to aisle 20 to find what they're looking for. There are people on that Walmart documentary who were really happy to do that every day. And we're just like, you know, I make people's lives slightly easier and interact with people and smile at them. And, you know, we have a little exchange, and that's nice. And, you know, that can be nice. But I think that a lot of that is something that we should just see more of in normal community, I suppose, in neighborhoods, just knowing people, having positive social interactions kind of all the time, rather than, you know, having that be your job to provide a positive social interaction to someone. I don't know. I didn't fully think that out. But anyway, fighting over retail sales jobs, I don't think is the future that a lot of people envisioned for themselves when they either went to school or just thought about when they were a little kid, you know, what do they want to do when they grow up? It's not exactly being an astronaut. But with the kind of economy that we have, you know, that's so focused on consumption, it's so focused on just moving stuff through the system. It needs stuff to survive. And the people have to move that stuff. So truck drivers, salespeople, customer service people for when the stuff breaks or when it needs to be replaced or people have a question about it. Someone's got to answer the phone to tell them that. The food service, that stuff, you know, it's going to move through all of our bodies, etc. The stuff has to keep moving is basically the very dumbed down. That's as simple as I can make economics, I think. The stuff has to keep moving for this kind of system to continue. It doesn't matter what the stuff is, which is what's interesting about it. It just has to have abstract value at that moment. So we're building Walmarts. We're building a Target on the South Hill. We're doing all of this. There's plenty of unemployed people to fill all the labor when we need them. When we don't need them, you know, and we'll just kind of use those people for political gain and talk about it a lot and talk about it as though it's a problem we're concerned about. But until the, you know, owning class needs the labor, they'll pretty much be sitting, waiting. So minimum wage jobs, there are a lot of them, as I just said, and there's more coming, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I saw in the Inlander this week that Mary Lou Reed, who does editorials from time to time about North Idaho, she wrote this editorial about minimum wage, and I'll just read it and then talk about it a little bit. An old Frank Sinatra song puts the American dream to music. You could be better off than you are. You could be swinging on a star. But stars to swing on are not in the skies of the 31,000 Idaho workers who eke out a living on jobs paying the $7.25 an hour minimum wage here. At that rate, one employee working full-time will only pull in $15,000 a year. The result is a borderline poverty-level existence and eligibility for food stamps. That is, if the U.S. Senate restores the food stamps that the House of Representatives just voted away. Idaho, along with several other states, raises the minimum wage only when Congress chooses to do so. President FDR set the first minimum wage in 1938 at a mere 25 cents an hour. The $7.25 an hour rate set by Congress in 2009 has rapidly become outdated. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says that adjusted for inflation, FDR's two-bit minimum would now translate to $10.56 an hour. In his 2013 State of the Union speech, President Obama announced support for bringing the national minimum wage up to at least $9 an hour. In March of this year, House Republicans unanimously shot down a measure to raise the minimum wage to $10.10. It's still a political football to be tossed around. Here in Idaho, community activist Ann Ness is leading the charge to put an initiative on the 2014 ballot to raise the Idaho minimum wage to $8.10 by 2015, scarcely a radical request. The initiative campaign is striving to collect 84,000 Idaho voter signatures by April of next year to assure the measure is on the November 2014 ballot. That goal presents an enormous challenge, but petition carriers are encountering very few refusals. Polls show strong support nationwide for raising the minimum wage to at least $10. If the signatures are gathered and the measure is passed by voters, this Idaho initiative would give a healthy boost to our local economy and stimulate job creation. I'm in total support of the initiative, says Mary Lou Reed. I'm just reading her statement. But Idaho's economic problems stretch beyond the minimum wage. Idaho reflects the growing disparity between the very wealthy and the working poor. Sinatra also saying, if you hate to go to school, you may turn out to be a mule. In today's world, going to school and playing by the rules doesn't guarantee a stroll up the ladder of success. Any person anywhere can be caught mulishly working two or three jobs just to fend off debts and keep food on the table. Closer to home, we have to ponder why Idaho has the highest percentage of minimum wage jobs in the country. How can Washington State, with a minimum wage of $9.19 and more than four times the population, have fewer actual minimum wage jobs than Idaho? And Washington's number of minimum wage jobs fell by 6.5% last year. Idaho shares a temperate climate with our neighboring state, Washington. Here in the Idaho Panhandle, we even share all forms of weather, rain, snow, sunshine, and wind, but we don't share policies. The most alarming statistic shows that Idaho is number one in the nation in the percentage of increasing minimum wage jobs. In 2012, Idaho saw a 63% increase in the number of minimum wage jobs over 2011. No other state was even close. We can surmise that lots of senior citizens are moving to the state and low-paying service jobs are expanding to meet their needs. At the same time, many young couples are moving out of the state to find better jobs and a more predictable future education for their kids. Mike Ferguson, director of the Idaho Center for Fiscal Policy and longtime Idaho budget director, notes that Idaho barely registers with many occupations and wages paid for them. And he notes that Idaho is not attracting high-tech or cutting-edge companies to locate in the state. Idaho is winning the race to the bottom, Ferguson says. He's written that Idaho lawmakers should put aside ideology and strive for excellence in taking care of the public's interests. I say public education tops the list of neglected priorities. Health care is a close second. This all reminds me of a prediction by business professor and social scientist Richard Florida that future economic prosperity will be won by communities that welcome the creative class, made up of diverse individuals and vigorous innovators. Corporations are drawn to communities that nourish colleges and universities, strong public schools and libraries, music, theater, and the arts. Thankfully, Idaho's cities lead in programs with a cultural bent that build a sense of community. Unfortunately, Idaho's leaders are trapped in an ideological stalemate. Policymakers need a tall glass of vision juice and a goal to take moonbeams home in a jar. While we wait for them to get with it, let's boost Idaho's minimum wage. So, pretty interesting there. It looks like, you know, Idaho is worse off than we are in Washington. We're all kind of in the same boat of being tied to this model of reliance on large corporations. She got to it right at the end there. She said, you know, she basically said the goal is still to attract these large companies to come and employ us. And that doesn't seem like it's a Band-Aid, obviously. There's unemployed people. They'll have something to do. But is more Walmart or even more, you know, Boeing or Avista or any of those, is that good? Is that actually good? Is that what we want for the future? There's a lot of work to be done as far as, you know, wanting to transition out of a fossil fuel based economy and lifestyle and infrastructure. That's something that needs to be done because it's not going to last forever, as, you know, all scientists agree. All meaning a very negligible gap that was probably paid to disagree. But the oil's not going to last forever. And at some point in the, you know, in the near future, in practical terms, we need to start addressing that. So there's no shortage of work to do. You know, there's feeding people to be done. It's something like 1 in 3 children in the U.S. are food insecure, meaning that at some point their parent doesn't know where their next meal is going to come from. And that's insane. So people are working all the time, right? 2 or 3 part-time jobs, spending a ton of hours either looking for work or actually working, and yet don't even have, you know, the pittance to show for it that they're able to feed their children. Like, that should be incredibly basic. So I'm going to play a little short clip of good old Noam Chomsky talking about this concept of wage slavery, and then possibly also play a short clip of an interview that I did last year with a local professor. I need to preview it, but I think it's pretty topical. I haven't listened to it in a while. But yeah, so this is Noam Chomsky talking about wage slavery.
Okay, I mean, the principle, as far as I can see, goes right back to the Enlightenment. Like, if you go back to classical Enlightenment thought, I'm not talking about Adam Smith and, you know, Jefferson and those guys. The sort of core idea is people have the right to control their own work. Okay, that if a person, here I'll quote a standard formula back in the 18th century, you know, leading heroes of the Enlightenment, is if a person works on it, if a person does beautiful work under external command, meaning for wages, we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is, because he's not a free human being. Okay. Now that goes all the way through classical liberal thought, Enlightenment thought. I mean, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville says, under wage labor, the art advances, the artisan declines. Now, you find this going right into the working class movements in Lowell and Lawrence. I think that's just natural. I wouldn't try to convince anybody of it. It seems to me if you think about it, yeah, why should you work on command? I mean, if you work on command, you're some kind of slave. You know? Why not work because it's coming out of your needs and interests? I mean, like, cheap for me to say, I'm in a fancy university in a science department and I can do that. One of the nice things about being in sciences at fancy universities, you really do have workers' control. To a very large extent, we control what we do. You know, want to work on this topic, I work on that topic. I mean, you got to sell it to funders and this and that. But the degree of workers' control at the elite level is quite substantial. I mean, that's why it's such a privilege to be in a science department. You know, enormously privileged existence. Forget the money. If they pay you 1/10 the amount of money, it would still be a much better existence than working on command. Now, I think people do know that. You know, I don't think that these Enlightenment ideas are hard to grasp. I think people know that if you work under external control, you may despise, admire what the person does, but despise what he is, because his labor, you know, the sort of central part of your life, is being done at somebody else's orders. And you're not controlling the way it's done or why it's done or how it's used or anything else. Well, you can't have every individual controlling every single thing, but that's why you have a democratic structure, because people control things together. You know? Okay, I don't know how to, I wouldn't try to convince anybody of this, because I frankly just don't believe that everyone doesn't know. I think maybe I'm sentimental, but it seems to me if you sort of cut away waves of, you know, layers of distortion and delusion, these things that were considered pretty obvious 200 years ago are still obvious.
All right. Sorry that beat is so loud in the background of that video. I didn't realize it was. Caller, are you with me? No, that call got dropped. If you were the person who just called, do call back. 747-3807. When I sampled that video on my laptop earlier, the beat in the background was not so loud. So, dear folks on YouTube, please leave loud music off of the background of your videos. But anyway, you know, the gist of what he's saying is that, you know, working on command in the structure that we have for wages, you know, is degrading. I don't know if he used the word because I was distracted by the beat and the phone ringing. So, yeah, basically, though, you know, to sell your labor on command limits your freedom, which is what Chomsky's saying there. And the alternative to that, because I think partially because I haven't done the best job of wording things this morning, I'm a little fuzzy, I guess. But also just in general, talking about this, a lot of people, because they've been absorbing this information about, you know, Protestant work ethic and welfare queens and a lot of these myths, that there's just people who don't want to work at all and just don't want to do anything and they just want to live off other people's labor. I think that's probably true in a small minority of people. But that's not, you know, people who criticize the system, a lot of them aren't doing it because they're lazy. But in fact, because their talents could be so much better utilized in a system that valued things differently. I know so many talented people who are, you know, barely scraping by because it's difficult for them to do this, you know, to play this game, to do this project. I fall into that category myself. Just, you know, seeing the mismanagement of the resources that this system, this global economic system, coupled with the government system that it runs, seeing just the chaos that, not total chaos, but the lack of results for average people, and the just deafening scale of the negative impacts of this system on the planet. There was just a photo on Facebook, the North Pole, you can see water at the North Pole. That should be a giant red flag for everyone. Alberta Tar Sands page posted that this morning. And meanwhile, you know, what used to be a beautiful lush rainforest in Alberta is now a desert because of this project. Looks like that caller's calling back, so we're going to bring them on. Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, sorry I hung up on you there.
Oh no. I just wanted to make a couple of comments here. Just, I can't quote exactly, but there were interesting men of the last century remarked that a job is at best a poor thing. And I think most of us who have had a lifetime of jobs would agree. Thorsten Veblen points at why, in our society, labor is not honorable. What's honorable is money. That's the system. That's the culture. And Thoreau said, and I think Chomsky was saying something about this, if you know what you want to do, do it. But in our society, people's minds are colonized by commercial media, Hollywood, to the extent that they will never learn what they want to do. And our education system serves the greater society. Thoreau's comment on that was that if you want to be a poet, go out there at once, which is fine. But once again, you have to know what it is you want. And it's not easy to find out in society.
Yeah, I think, Thoreau was big for me when we read. I'm surprised they let us read Thoreau in high school because that probably sparked a lot of dangerous impulses in people's minds, especially people who were, you know, poets or something like that, like you said, where...
Telling the truth, just like Howard Zinn.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Who just got banned from schools in Illinois, I think.
Indiana,
thank you. Yeah, so... What do you think, I don't know, what do you think is, I'm trying to shift to solutions, and what do you think is a good path to head forward and just have more meaningful livelihood for people and get some of the actual work done that we have to get done?
this system that we're living in can't be reformed. It's, you know, we have this, what people call the market system, and capitalists and businessmen and politicians use the word rather blithely. What we have is not exactly a market. It's monopolistic or oligopolistic. It's corporatist, and it's a capitalist system. There's nothing free market about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't operate for the benefit of all the people. It operates for the benefit of a very small minority of people. And there's a buffer. There's a buffer class between the rich and the poor, you know, which we call the middle class, but it's shrinking, and at the bottom, you've only got so many hours of life to live when you come to the world. Why would we give them to someone whose product you may not respect, whose person you may not respect, in fact, whose activities you may find immoral? If this is the system that we live in.
Yeah, and since it can't be reformed, as you said, and I would definitely tend to agree with you, then it has to go and be replaced.
It's going to fall apart.
Yeah, I think it has to. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can really come to. And hopefully it won't take everything else with it, you know. Right as you called, I was talking about some of the environmental implications of this system that wants to just keep making stuff and keeping the stuff moving at all costs. And hopefully it falls apart before, like I said, it takes everything else with it. So,
well, you have to, this is they call it a consumer society. A consumer is a kind of appetite, which is a kind of emptiness. And collectively, we're just a big nothing. You know, there's nothing spiritual here in the United States. That's dead. Much of what passes for religion here is nothing but politics. All we have is materialism. Stop. It's a disease. We all have, you know, an attic full of stuff, a car trunk full of stuff, the closet full of stuff. We have a storage house in the backyard full of stuff.
Yeah. Well, the good news there is I guess we won't have to be making any more stuff at the point when the resources make that more difficult. But that's kind of a dark, bright spot.
Resources are beginning to squeeze the system a little bit. The system is going to go on, but it's probably going to fall apart for other reasons. Anybody who's listening has read David Stockman's recent publication called The Great Deformation. Stockman was Ronald Reagan's first-term budget director, and he spent more than a decade with Blackstone Corporation. He's a Wall Street operator, and he's more or less saying that we're on the way out. And although, like every writer who has a Jeremiah, he ends a book with a bright, an uplifting possibility. These positive possibilities for the future are looking less and less likely as time goes by. We're here. We're doing nothing. Time goes by. The most recent report on methane emissions is that, and this is wonderful. In one area of the Arctic, methane, and just an area, I think it's Siberia, that methane emissions from that area alone are going to amount to an economic cost of $70 trillion. Now they're trying to they're trying to make people understand by referring to money, but still, what our problem is different here. Our problem is really is not, you know, at bottom, our problem is what we are. Not a matter of them and us. It's always what we are, what a human being is. You know, a kind of a pastiche of impression each of us receives from other people. We're put together from the outside rather than from the inside out. We come into the world with a biologic quality, but then the environment acts on it. First, our parents, we're enculturated at first by our parents and then by the society, you know, beginning in, you know, when we go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And we're mortal beings, but we don't have the capacity intellectually really to understand that. Life is much mystery to us as death is. And yet we are engineered, we're put together as an expression of life force. So we are always, we're always positive about our life, even when we have, you know, fourth stage cancer. We battle the cancer, as they say. We struggle against this death. And a great deal, you know, look at what we spend on insurance, health insurance, hospitals. You know, that's 17% of our economy. And plus life insurance, plus the military, the police, all the things we do to securitize our lives are something almost like a worship of death. It's almost like
the
pyramids in Egypt. It's bizarre. But all this is Ernest Becker. And the idea is that evil grows out of our fear of mortality. The evil that we produce in the world grows out of what we are as creatures. And we're in denial. The reason that we don't deal with it is because we repress thoughts of our mortality. We put a lid on it, and we sit on the lid with great fear that something's going to blow the lid off.
This is
a large part of our life.
That's a good... Who did you say, Ernest Becker? Is that...
Ernest Becker.
That's because I think that I'm trying to lately have empathy for people who I would generally just consider evil and dismiss as such. But I think that fear of death is a big part of it, and it's really a Western notion. And I think people like Thoreau, to go back to you mentioning Thoreau, the reason I connected so much with that when I first started reading him as a teenager is that, you know, how did he figure the things out? He figured out he went into nature and saw, oh, check it out. Nature's immortal. I'm part of that. Maybe this death thing isn't so horrifying after all, and maybe we can start to consider broader possibilities. So the irony, unfortunately, of this, you know, fear of mortality culture that's pushing forward is that it's destroying nature. So, and they're, you know, destroying the mirror that we have to look to for a different way of being humans.
Yes. Exactly.
But you can still laugh about it, so we'll probably be okay, I hope.
No, we're not going to be okay.
Well,
I'm going to, I'll come down sometime next week if I get a chance. Do you operate out of the office?
I'm here on Monday mornings, but you should definitely send me an email at Praxis.
I don't do email.
Oh, okay. Well, then you should definitely.
I'll drop a letter, and I've got
a
CCD for you. You've got a minute to.
Great. Thanks. And what was your name?
My name's Jim.
Jim, well, thank you for joining me on the air.
Okay,
and...
well, I hate to use the phrase, thank you for having me, which sounds a little bit odd always to me when I hear it on the radio, but yeah, thanks for making this time available.
Yeah, definitely. Have a great day.
You too.
Well, that was Jim. I love getting calls live. Thanks for calling in. And I think that he really helped me tie a lot of things together I was having trouble with from not planning the show out very well. But there we go. It all works out. So so we started at wages and wage slavery and working for the sake of working and having a job and listening to that Chomsky quote. And if you're just joining me, you're listening to Praxis. That's where we're talking about all of these subversive notions of not wanting to work, not because of being lazy, but because, as Jim just suggested on the phone, that maybe humans are meant to do something more than, you know, spend their lives toiling for the sake of not dying. It's kind of the irony he started to point to there. It's like people want to preserve their life for so long, but they don't even have a chance to really live it if they're just working all the time. So it's like, maybe eventually so that you can retire, I guess, when you're in your 60s. And, you know, if you've taken care of yourself during all that time of working, you'll have the physical ability to enjoy that. But I would rather, I've been telling people I'm retired right now. I would rather be enjoying that and making myself useful and finding my talents and sharing them with people and making the world a better place without having to worry about, you know, paying rent to a landlord, paying a gigantic astronomical electric bill to a private company that sets the rates pretty willy-nilly. I'm not going to go on a rant about Avista right now, I promise. But there are people who are figuring out ways to do the work of society that needs to be done, the feeding people, the you know, the rebuilding of infrastructure, the building of infrastructure that actually works, you know, so that in the future, when the fossil fuels are gone, cities as they exist now, aren't going to happen in that. I mean, they're so reliant on the world outside them, the resources that lie outside of cities, that they're incredibly vulnerable islands of dependency, basically. And that's what I see being a huge portion of the work, the actual physical work that's going to be need to be done in the next, you know, well, 30 years ago, but, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we need to build cities that support themselves, or else there just is no future for cities. And since there's so many more urban residents than rural at this point in the game, that's kind of a mandate if we want people in cities to survive. I talked with Margaret and Elf a couple weeks ago from Bruce Rule Design, and that's their vision that they're working on. They're having a lot of success in Spokane moving forward with that. I really admire them. They're kind of just saying, you know what? We have a plan. Your plan's not working. And they have such a nice, like, diplomatic way of coming at it and saying, we have an idea we think will work, and we need your help. And it's working with all of these large institutions, which I think shows that a lot of these places, they know that they need to do something different. I think they're trapped in the inertia of doing the wrong thing for so long. It's easy in this society and culture to keep doing the wrong thing. It's incentivized, in fact. Stay on the path, even if it's leading to, you know, total destruction. Just stay on the path, you know, keep going, and we'll make sure that you're taken care of if you keep us on this path, which doesn't make any sense. Another example that I've been involved in the past, we're hoping to revive currently. I can talk about it because it's not a job. I'm not paid for it. But Food Not Bombs is one example. Any like church soup kitchen is another. Food Not Bombs has a more intentionally political bent. And they, for folks who don't know, the website, the international website's foodnotbombs.net. And they basically, it's a slightly different model in every city, but the basic gist is to take food that's going to be wasted, which is so much in the U.S. We could probably feed the world from our dumpsters. Food that's going to be wasted, overstock from supermarkets. It's like they build partnerships with different wasters of food. Some chapters in some cities do it from dumpsters and from, you know, garbage and stuff. And they're careful about what they end up giving out, but, and some buy, I think some also on the other side, buy food and cook it up. Many though use the donation model. So get donations of food that's going to be wasted, cook it up, usually vegan or vegetarian, and serve it for free to absolutely anyone who wants it in the street. So they're sharing food. It's a big potluck. Anyone can show up and just take food that's been cooked by these volunteers. They on their website, their slogan is sort of food is a right, not a privilege. So, you know, you shouldn't have to work for money in order to get food, just because a system has been imposed that keeps you from, in most cases, unless you live by a crazy wild park like some of the ones in Spokane and you have knowledge of edible plants, there is free food to be had outside of the dumpsters, but that knowledge has been lost in a lot of senses. It exists on the internet with all other knowledge. So if you have the privilege to have internet access, you should use it for practical skills like that. But so anyway, Food Not Bombs, they feed people for free. And this is what happens when you do work outside of a job context like that. There's a big history of Food Not Bombs chapters being penalized by cities during which they live. Here is, let's see, this is about stuff in the U.S. Since it's international, there's a lot of news. But authorities are seeking to stop or reduce the impact of Food Not Bombs in Detroit, Portland, Boulder, and Seattle, close to home, during summer of 2013. This follows past threats successfully resisted by organizing global days of protest and refusing to cave in to local authorities. It has been distressing to receive so many reports in the past few months. First, the state of New Mexico fined Food Not Bombs $500 in June. They backed off after the group resisted. News that the city wants to drive Boulder Food Not Bombs out of sight came in July 2013. People are being threatened with arrest or cities adopting new laws limiting people's right to share free food with the public. Over 40 cities have passed laws banning or limiting volunteers from sharing food in public. Burlington, Vermont, Santa Cruz, California, and Seattle, Washington started 2013 with efforts to drive hunger out of sight. A new wave of attacks started during summer of 2013. People in England, California, Texas, South Carolina, and Florida contacted Food Not Bombs about having been threatened with arrest. Others report that their local governments are considering laws to limit acts of compassion. This new wave of threats is happening as half of all Americans are struggling to survive. The Department of Agriculture's February report shows that 46,286,294 people relied on food stamps in November of 2011. People have been arriving at Food Not Bombs meals claiming they've not eaten in 4 days because other food programs have exhausted their resources. The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that 1 in 7 people, or 925 million people, worldwide went hungry in 2010. We're announcing a global campaign to recognize that sharing food with the hungry is an unregulated activity of compassion and should not be interfered with by the authorities. So, local governments, and I haven't been involved in any interruption of Food Not Bombs activity in Spokane. My involvement has been pretty limited, and I don't know the full history as far as being hassled by local police or laws or anything like that. It's just so disappointing. This just shows, this is one more example of our governmental structures being allied with the status quo. That is the mandate. It's not a mandate in the official sense, but anyone who reaches the level to be elected to those types of, you know, to even in a city the size of Spokane, once elected, there's so much momentum behind the status quo that suddenly doing things like limiting the ability of people to feed each other for free seems like it makes sense to people. And I'd be very disappointed to see that happen in Spokane. So I'm hoping it never does. But there are passionate people everywhere doing what they want to do outside of the traditional system. And the more people do it, the easier it becomes. So, you know, the trap, you know, the wage slavery trap, as it were, of having to work just enough to pay your bills, maybe have a tiny amount of savings. I'd say the people under 30 I know, very few of them have any savings to speak of whatsoever. Maybe an emergency like amount of your rent tucked away, but it's a treadmill. It's called that for a reason. People, we have all these expressions for this. We talk about it, but we don't talk about moving beyond it very often. And it's something we just have to do, you know, to reclaim dignity and self-sufficiency and all kinds of good things that I don't think many people would argue with. So, where's I going with that? The more that people decide that the system we have is ludicrous and that people deserve better, you know, deserve better than perpetual debt and working for a wage that's actually deflated since the 1920s, since the Gilded Age, which everyone points to as like the bottom like dregs of what's bad about capitalism. If we're in what's worse than that, like to move out of that requires that people begin to do it. And that's difficult because then it puts the onus of acting upon the very people who are victimized by the system. And that's difficult. But it's still necessary. And we see people doing it all the time. So it's very interesting to think about. This hour kind of ended up flying by because I was rambling. I hope that you got something of value from it. Sorry again about the loudness of the music in the background of that Chomsky piece. I'm not sure what that was all about. I'll have to more carefully screen that stuff in the future. But basically, yes, a long rant that was hopefully semi-productive about this idea of work for work's sake and having a job and wage slavery, as it were. I feel like I'll get called melodramatic for using that term, but I don't think it's a melodramatic one to choose. This has been Praxis on KYRS. Thin Air Community Radio. Feel free to contact me with topic ideas, interviews, etc. at any time at praxis@kyrs.org. This program and the rest of the archive will be podcast at kyrs.org under Programming Podcasts Praxis. Have a great Monday.